And I hope you all will tune in again every day this week, from the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, for the rest of this series, The World of Brothers, Freddie Gray, produced by the students at Stephanie Mavronis-Nyer, teaching at UMBC. We're now joined here in studio, and welcome back to Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We have with us now Joshua Harris, co-founder of the Hollands Creative Placemaking, but I guess more importantly at the moment, he is now the mayoral candidate for the Green Party in Baltimore. Good to have you here, Joshua.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
And you all can join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talkatsteinershow.org by email. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. But bring your thoughts and ideas and questions here for Joshua Harris, 410-319-8888, who some people say are taking on a quixotic run at the mayoralty, taking on the likes of Catherine Pugh. What do you say when people say that to you, Joshua?
I think that it's very evident right now, not just on the national level, but locally, that people are tired of politics and business as usual, and they're looking for something different and something that's going to benefit the people and put people first unapologetically over corporate interest and corporate entities. And I am that here in Baltimore City. And there's an opportunity, an opportune time right now for people to really vote based on policy and the best interests of the people rather than traditional politics and what many would say viability, whatever that means, right?
So you began in the very beginning. I remember when we first started these conversations in the air. You ran first in the Democratic primary but dropped out, moved to Green. Pardon me.
Mm-hmm.
So what? Talk a bit about, just for our listeners for background, why you did that.
Well, understanding that one, when you look at, I'm a student of history, and so when you look at the history of the policies that have been implemented in Baltimore City, again, understanding that Baltimore's a town that's been Democratic in title, and I'd say title alone. A majority of the policies have been what many would say are Republican in nature. The way that we so quickly give away millions of our tax dollars to major corporations and developers, as we're seeing Port Covington being pushed through right now as quickly as possible, even at the expense of our schools, at the expense of our roads, at the expense of our young people. Those aren't traditional, what we would say, Democratic values. And understanding the Green Party is a party that has valued social justice, including racial justice, environmental justice, and economic justice, vocally and supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement, not just locally, but nationally as well. I felt it was a party that more aligned with my values and vision. And most importantly, I felt that in Baltimore City, we needed leadership that was unapologetically willing to take a stand and stand for what's right, regardless of party affiliation or what the status quo is. We need politics that has integrity to it and isn't co-opted necessarily by years of being a part of these machines that we see that have, in many cases in Baltimore City, destroyed many of our communities and neglected them and forgotten about them.
So, folks, do join us, 410-319-8888, as we talk with Joshua Harris, who is the Green Party candidate for mayor in the election that comes up in November. Got a long way to go here. 410-319-8888. So please join us. Write to us here at talkatsteinershow.org. We'll read your questions and your thoughts for Joshua Harris as we continue this conversation. So let's talk a bit about what you mentioned, Port Covington. So Port Covington is, many people would argue, at least the first part of it is a fait accompli. It'll probably happen before you or anybody else becomes mayor in December. Let's say for argument's sake that's the case. So what does the next mayor do to ensure that this is just not a runaway deal for a few people building a section of the city for people of means and create something different? When Joshua Harris plan that will handle that?
Well, I think that we don't have to wait until we have a next mayor. We are all in this together. This is our city, and no matter what you're doing, and I'm running for mayor right now, but I'm still advocating on behalf of the citizens in Baltimore as a whole. So I think what I'm doing and what I think any other candidate is doing is advocating on what is in the best interest of the city as a whole, and how do we make sure we have comprehensive community benefits agreements put in place? How do we make sure that we're not jeopardizing the city's bond rating, which actually Port Covington does do. We're at AA. It'll compromise us to probably a single A bond rating. But also making sure that we're putting things in place and advocating for the current administration to push for the people to be protected and for us to really put some investment in other places in the city. you know, there's just, I mean, the TIF before this, which we're still working and speaking with the council on, which was given to the University of Maryland Biopark. We're still advocating to try to get the Poppleton Training Academy endowed, which would train people in construction, green jobs, and hospitality, the exact jobs that would go towards implementing Port Covington, and wouldn't give them an out to say, well, you don't have qualified people to do these jobs. And so had we had measures like that put in place to be proactive, we would be a little further ahead and prepare for something like this. And so I'm going to continue to advocate and push and show up to meetings and send emails for a comprehensive community benefits agreement that really works for the greater benefit of the city as a whole.
But let's say, for argument's sake, you became mayor, and the Port Covington deal had been approved all the way down the line, which means at least the first phase of it is there. That has to come in phases, so there's lots of room, wiggle room. There's lots of room to argue about how you will leverage the debt, what really happens there. I mean, what would you, if you walked in the door and Port Covington was already there, what would you do?
Well, right now we're plowing through the 535-page application, which is a page for every $1 million that they're asking for, actually. So talk about
it. Never thought about it that way.
Yeah, it's a page for every $1 million they're asking for. But so one of the things that I have in my platform that I'm looking to do is, how do we leverage the wealth that we have in the city and use it to generate more wealth? And so understanding that right now Baltimore City stores its money in a bank, and understanding that banks get rich off of other people's money. They take our money, your money, my money, and they make investments off of, and they use it to leverage to create more wealth for the institution. And so if we had what we call public banking here in Baltimore, we had a Baltimore City Bank, knowing that we have a $3 billion operating budget, we have a $98 million rainy day fund that's sitting in a bank just waiting, could be leveraged for investments, we could leverage our own finances to create more wealth to be able to do more projects of this sort and invest in the community at large as a whole. And so what that means and what that would do for the citizens here in the city is that, understanding in Baltimore, you can purchase a vacant home for anywhere between $2,000 and $5,000, just a shell. You can rehab that home for anywhere between $50,000 and $70,000.
If you're lucky.
That's actually, you're pretty good. You can do some pretty good renovations on it. And knowing that a traditional bank, though, won't give you a loan for that amount, because they'd much rather give $1 million loan away with the same paperwork, higher return on interest. But we would be able to provide home loans to people who otherwise wouldn't be able to get home loans. We could be able to provide small interest business loans to businesses who are starting up. And we could even offer lesser interest rates, because we wouldn't be driven strictly by profit the way that a traditional banking institution is. And this is actually one of the ways that the state of North Dakota avoided the stock market crash of 2008, because they were in control of all their funds and they weren't involved with Wall Street. They were leveraging their own capital to create more long-term investments. And right now, it's extremely important, because the two TIFs back, Harbor Point, we're paying 19% interest on the municipal bonds from $107 million. 19% interest, which you wonder why taxes are going up. Everyone complains about taxes. We have to make up for things like that. Like, we're paying 19% interest. And not only are we paying 19% interest, but we're paying 19% interest to the developer who purchased $42 million of the bonds after we gave him $107 million up front, which is absurd.
So two things here. Listeners, do join us at 410-319-8888. I was just thinking that, you know, we know Sheila Dixon and Catherine Pugh are still waiting to see what these results will be. But that shouldn't stop from calling. I know the election was just happening. It might have some fatigue. But unfatigue yourself. Talk with Joshua Harris. See what he's got to say. Push him. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts for him in this election. But to come back to what you said, I'm very familiar with the North Dakota Bank, and what they did. But some people would argue back at you that every time the city has gotten involved in that kind of running a private institution like they did with the Hilton Hotel, it's ended up as a disaster. Mm-hmm. What does the city know about banking? I mean, you know what I'm saying? The Dakota Bank has been around for 50, 60 years. It's an institution came out of the Depression when those things were popping up all over the country. They maintained their state bank, but it has a long history. So developing that institution is no easy trick, it seems to me.
No, it's not. And it's not something that, and I think it's very important that we be clear here, that we do not want the city managing a bank. No, the city would not manage it. They would provide policy and oversight, but we want to hire professionals that this is what they do is banking, and bring them in to really leverage the city's income, just like they would be if they were working on Wall Street, and so that we could have the ability to compete and minimize some of the debt that the city is incurring. So it is something something that takes time, and you need professionals who are experienced at this. But we have them. We have them right here in this city. We have them that, from all over, that we can use their experiences we can use their experiences to our advantage, if you will. And so I don't want City Hall people thinking that our city council is going to be managing the day-to-day operations of a bank, or even having input on what happens with the money and how that works. We would definitely bring in professionals to do that.
Folks, 410-319-8888 is the number here. We're talking with Joshua Harris. We're taking a short break and come back. We're going to tackle issues the diminution of mayoral power, talk a bit about this AA bond, talk about the murders in the city of Baltimore, police-community relations, what's happening with the future of the police in the city and public safety, and a great deal more, education in our school system. 410-319-8888. We'll be back with Joshua Harris, Green Party candidate for mayor. This is Mark Steiner. Join us here for a conversation with Joshua Harris, who is the Green Party candidate for mayor of Baltimore. 410-319-8888. You can write to us here by email, talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. John, you're the first caller up. We're going to come to your call after I throw this question out to Joshua. Then you're up, 410-319-8888, to join in on this conversation. One of the things I wanted to probe here was that we talked about last week on the program, which was that ever since Freddie Gray's funeral and the uprising began, there have been almost a murder a day in the city. Three or four people shot on top of that, per day on top of that one. Over this last weekend, we saw at least five people shot, from what I've read, and one person was killed. And if you talk with community activists and organizers in the city, apart from the police, which we'll come to in a minute, the issue of violence in the community is a very serious one. And that kind of violence doesn't usually take place here, where we're sitting at Morgan State, nor does it take place in Roland Park or Mount Washington, but takes place in the poorest communities in Baltimore, which means it's even more intense for the folks who live there. Mm-hmm. So, and no mayor seems to ever have a answer to this, at least adequate by my estimation. What is a city policy that addresses the growth of violence in our communities, and how to stem it, and how to help communities handle it themselves?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's a two-tier approach that I see that from, and one is health in all policies, and understanding that violence is an issue of public health, and understanding the conditions in which community members or communities operate in that lead to issues of anxiety, issues of mental health that need to be addressed that aren't being addressed, all sorts of issues combined with lack of access to fresh fruits and produce and vegetables. It's all a multifaceted health approach that we have to really look at. How do we provide access to resources to help these communities begin to heal themselves? And so what that looks like, particularly from a mental health component, and that in some of these communities, it's the conditions that have been put in place have essentially, for all intents and purposes, could be considered small war zones. And so how do we navigate that? And I believe that those conditions, again, were caused by lack of investment and resources and opportunity. And so the theme of my campaign is Baltimore is for all of us, and making sure that we reallocate and redistribute capital to make investments in all of our neighborhoods, and understanding that many of these neighborhoods have been divested in for years. And so I don't mean just write them a check and give them a check, but make investments in the people. And so how do we make sure that we're going into these communities and that we're able to not only set up programs, but that these programs are being run by people who effectively know how to reach the people that we want to serve? Because that's also something that we see in city with a lot of city agencies and programs. We have these programs that are run by really heavily degreed people who are really smart, but have absolutely no clue how to interact with or how to reach the people that they want to serve. And so that means being very proactive in bringing people, meeting people where they are and where they're at, and bringing people to the table from the communities who are already engaged, actively involved, and helping them to help us really provide resources, whether it be mental health evaluations, whether it mean job training programs, understanding then soft skills training programs that guarantee employment, because it's one thing to just do a training and say, well, now you have a resume, you know how to write a resume, but we're going to work with you to give you a skill that you will always have, and we're going to make sure that you have employment. And there's programs out that, like the Thrive Workforce program, that does that, and it has a leadership development component to it built into the first 3 months of it that young men 17 to 24 have to go through, and then they're guaranteed employment upon completion of the program. And so making sure that we're being very, we're targeting on a microcosm, really making the investment in people first. And many people may say that they're afraid to walk through the communities or to talk to communities. I heard a young lady last week or somewhere, and she said that she felt fearful. And we also have to ask ourselves, are we building and perpetuating the isolation of these communities by our own inherent biases to them? Like, when's the last time you stopped to have a conversation and ask someone what their story was or try to communicate with them? So how do we break down these walls and really begin to open up the doors and provide opportunities into many of these communities that have such high rates of violence?
So what do you do immediately to begin to try to deal with that high rate of violence that's taking place in communities? It's very real. I mean, if you in four or five communities I can name right now where most of it takes place, it's a very real and frightening day-to-day reality where people in communities don't know what fear the guys in the corner as much as they do fear the cops in the car. Mm-hmm. So what do you do? You're mayor. What do you do?
I believe that it starts with the investment in young people. And so and my community that I live in is one of those communities. I've had 3 people killed within 2 blocks of my door in the last 4 months. So understand it. I live in one of those communities, so I get it. But the investment in young people is really key. We have to really invest in, as I think it was Frederick Douglass that said, that we have to invest in building or creating healthy, raising healthy individuals rather than trying to fix broken ones. And there's a certain component of it that the reality is that some people are extremely broken. It's going to be more difficult to work there versus being proactive and invested in our youth. And even in my neighborhood, when you go to the recreation center, which is supposed to be a safe haven, they don't allow young people in there that are under 18 years of age. And that's a problem. They don't have any programming, and they have no place to go. So they end up in the streets. They end up talking. They end up getting into trouble and getting exposure, which will then lead them possibly into the future, into being in one of these negative interactions, whether it be with the police or on a corner, because idle hands are the devil's plaything. And so how do we change that narrative and be proactive about really investing in providing programming and resources for our young people? I truly believe that's what it's going to take.
Let me open the phones. A lot of people are calling in. I want to get to the police issue here in just a moment. 410-319-8888. Joshua Harris is with us, running for mayor of Baltimore on the Green Party ticket. 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org, by email. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. And John, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Good morning, John.
Yes, I'd just like to know if you're familiar with the book Listen Liberal by Thomas Frank, dealing with the collusion of the Democratic Party and the banking interests and whatever, and especially how it relates to Hillary Clinton. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it?
That's it.
Okay, thanks.
No, I'm not familiar with
it. I know the book, yeah.
I'm not familiar with the book, but it sounds like something I'd definitely be interested in checking out.
I'll give you a copy.
Okay.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go to Clarence. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner. Mr. Harris, I often think that politicians can do everything by law but still serve as a disinterest to the public. Now, when you look at Port Covington, $500 million, if you divided that by $30,000, okay, you would come up with 1,666 odd jobs. If you tax those jobs at 5%, it would take you 259 years for the city to recoup, to get $500 million in revenue back into their coffers. Doesn't that sound a little insane? You know, you can't even, the city could not recoup that within one person's lifetime. You know, how do you feel about that? The math doesn't lie. Thank you.
I think that's a really good point and a really good way of breaking it down and understanding what the city is about to do. I often relate it to, could an individual who has 2 children go to the city and say, hey, I have 2 children, a 7-year-old and an 8-year-old. They're going to grow up to be tax producing citizens. And I like for you to give me $52,000 per child in advance because of how much money they're going to earn the city in tax revenue in the future. And so you can't. And so understanding that, how can we more proactively make investments? But we also understanding that this investment in Port Covington is driven by profit. It's driven by a corporate institution that is a $1 billion institution and looking at how many more billions they can make in projected revenue if they are able to be successful with getting this through. And so we talk about the importance of public-private partnerships often. Unfortunately, what we've seen in Baltimore City is that we end up publicizing the intent of the endeavor, and then we end up privatizing the public's involvement in it, or we privatize the profit that'll be made, and we publicize the debt, which is what will happen in this case. The debt will go to the city, so that's going to be a public-private partnership for all intents and purposes. And we have to really reshape that narrative, and so I do think that they're moving this process really quickly. I also think that they're ineffectively negotiating this process. Mr. Plank and Under Armour are business people, and usually your first ask isn't for necessarily what you need. You ask for what you want in your best case scenario, and it should be the city's and the elected officials' responsibility to go back and counter that offer. Just like if you were purchasing a home, most people don't just accept the first offer. You want to see a counter. And so we have to get leadership that understands, again, what I come back to saying, the business of policy and how we make sure that we are we're making effective business decisions that are going to benefit the entire city as a whole.
410-319-8888 with Joshua Harris, running to become the next mayor of Baltimore. Let's go to line 3. Sylvia, you're on the air.
Good morning,
Sylvia.
I'm so happy to hear you talking with Joshua. He has my full support. This man is out there for us. He's out there for all of us, for the seniors, for the children, for the families, for the police department. He's saying mental health. Mental health is the way that we have to treat what is occurring with the violence. Unless people are drawn together and understand what's going on with themselves, we are never going to rid the violence. Mm-hmm. I'm so thankful for Joshua. I'm so thankful. And I'm so thankful for you having him there so that he can share his vision. We need the young leadership. And we need our young men to step forth and be the leaders that they can. He's a good example.
Thank you so much, Sylvia, for the call.
Thank you, Miss Sylvia. I appreciate it.
Let's go to, before I have to throw a question here, we have a lot of calls. I'm trying to get to all of you here. Let's go 410-319-8888. Let's go to Yasmin in Reservoir Hill, and then we'll go to Robert. Yasmin, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Good morning.
Good morning. So my issue with Baltimore City would be the property taxes. I'm from Baltimore County. I've lived in the city, been a city resident for about 10 years or so. And I really want to purchase a house this year. But the biggest issue I have are the property taxes. They are super high. My sister just bought a house in Baltimore County. And, I mean, her property taxes are, they're very reasonable. So I wanted to know what could realistically be done about property taxes to keep people like me in Baltimore City. I'm 32. I would love to start a family and live in the city, but the property taxes are so high.
You hear that a lot?
Yes, I do. I do hear that a lot.
We all do.
Yeah, and I think this comes back to 2 things as part of my vision and part of my plan. One, it comes back to understanding economic impact and economic injustice, which has happened, and public banking again. When you look at things like the Harbor Point TIF, 19% interest, and so many other decisions that we've made with pilots as well as TIFs, that now we're trying to recoup in finance, we have to make up for it. And so it comes in small incremental increases in property taxes and many other things. But then two, making sure that we're putting people to work in the city. And so, one, again, I come back to the request that we made to have the Poppleton Training Academy endowed, knowing that we have 40,000 plus vacant homes in this city that still have plumbing and electrical running to them, even though it may not be used, being used. It is a burden on the city's infrastructure that's not being used. So that also has to be made up for, the cost for that. But if we put people to work in living wage job opportunities and we train them to do the work of rehabbing these houses, now they're making living wages and they have the ability to purchase a home and become homeowners. And the more people we have becoming homeowners in the city, the less the burden it is on the dwindling homeowner base that we have right now in the city. Although we haven't been on decline for the last few years, we've made constant, but we did have suffer a large decline of people who left Baltimore City. And so they also, those who stayed, carried the burden of that load. And so if we are able to put more people in positions to own homes, whether it be being able to give them home loans that a traditional bank wouldn't give them because we have a public bank in place, or just because they're earning $30, $40 an hour and now they're not struggling to make ends meet, they can even consider the fact of becoming a homeowner in the city. I think that that will help to minimize the burden. There's also something I've spoke about the possibility of, which is a commuter tax, understanding that a large majority, I believe it's like 54% of the city's employees, don't live inside Baltimore City. And knowing that there's a lot of people that come into the city, they reap the benefits economically and take their money back out into surrounding counties. And also knowing that historically Baltimore City has been the lifeline for the surrounding counties. And so now it may be time for the surrounding counties to invest in helping Baltimore to get back up on its feet.
Well, two things. I mean, A, what you just said at the end, then I'm going to jump back to the phones here. Because I do want to get a question about the police before we get back to the phones as well. But that the community tax could be counterproductive because it works two ways. A lot of people from the city work in Baltimore County, Howard County, Prince George's County, in Anne Arundel County. They could do the same thing. It seemed to me that could add to more tension than growth, some people would argue. And B, I mean, if you had more housing stock, that would definitely add to the property tax. But already we have, I mean, all the apartment buildings are taxed, property taxed, right? And we have these giant swaths of our city owned by people like Hopkins, University of Maryland, prime real estate that are not taxed.
So
they're nonprofits. Mm-hmm. So as are many churches and synagogues and mosques that are not taxed as well. So it's a complex question about property taxes and lowering them and what that would do for the city coffers. I mean, it's not a simple. There's no simple answer here, it seems to me.
Oh, no. It's not simple at all. It's definitely it's going to take a comprehensive approach, a intact, long-term strategic plan. We can't piecemeal this together. We have to sit down and make sure that we're putting together a long-term plan and vision and execute it step by step. It has to be something that will be picked up, and it probably wouldn't be able to be completed in 4 years. It'll probably take at least 8 years to really see the impact and results of it. There's no microwave version here. And as for the commuter tax, the surrounding counties could do that. There is a possibility of that. But that's where it also comes into understanding one, coalition building and being able to work with the surrounding counties and their elected leadership. But then two, they know the history and they're just as invested in Baltimore's success as we are. Even when you look at Kevin Kamenetz, who recently was gifted $18 million in police overtime from last spring in the uprising, because he understands that they're just as invested in Baltimore as they are in the county, and because they're right next to them, we're partners, and they receive their water from us as well as many other resources. And so there's some things that I'm willing to go out on a limb and bet that many of the surrounding officials are invested and would like to see Baltimore be successful in any way that they can.
So we have like 15 minutes left here, and I want to make sure I get these callers in here that are all calling in. We just lost one. Robert, hold on. I'm going to come to your call next. And Mr. Lee, you're going to get to your call as well. So hold on, 410-319-8888. So public safety, on the other side of the coin, that we saw the young boy we talked about here last week that was shot in the leg by the police. One of the people who ran for mayor on the Democratic Party primary, Carl Stokes, called for a cut in the police department budget to invest that money in education and other places. And we've discussed in the show in the last week or so, and have for the last bunch of years, the idea that there should be an alternative to public safety. And there used to be the Fruit of Islam patrolling the high-rise houses. There were high-rise public housing when we had that. There are safe streets. Mm-hmm. There are other alternative programs that might have had a very different outcome had they then been the front line, with the police not being the front line, but their front line being actually solving the crime. So talk a bit about your approach to public safety here.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that, again, whether you're talking about the fruit of Islam or whether you're talking about safe streets, which are seeing tremendous strides and success in minimizing crime in the areas and communities that they've gone into, there's the overarching thing of cultural competency and what that means, and making sure that whoever it is that's going into these communities understand how to navigate that environment, and they understand how to diffuse and de-escalate situations rather than escalate them. And our officers are not yet trained in that, and it's not ingrained and incorporated into their training. And many of them, the first time that they interact, or the only time that they interact with the community or even understand the community, is when they're on patrol and they're looking for a suspect or a crime has been committed. And we have to change that by making sure that the community is involved in that process. And so the current commissioner is taking steps in the right direction towards what we often hear is community-based policing, which some people are like, well, what does that look like? What does that mean? It's a really comprehensive approach to making sure the community is involved in the process. He's taken steps in that direction by moving officers back to post command, so they're in a community consistently, and they get to know and interact and see the people that live, work, and play in that community, so they begin to understand and navigate it. They're moving towards foot patrols in certain communities. I don't see it in my community, but they're moving towards foot patrols in certain communities. And so making sure that those are components, but the greater component of it is making sure that the community is involved in the training and recruitment of the officers, so that they can have and ask questions and hear the stories and understand the culture of the communities that they're going into. The community should be involved in that process, as well as the review. Should an issue arise where a 13-year-old is shot by a police officer, who's reviewing that? Is it other officers, or is the community reviewing that from a non-biased perspective to really evaluate what should the outcomes be?
So you don't agree with Commissioner Davis that he should control who the civilian appointee would be, or appointees would be, to that review board inside the police department?
No, I don't agree with that. No.
Who would appoint them?
I think that it should be probably bringing in the council into that, to really bring in community members that they know can be relied upon and have done work in the community consistently, so they can identify them and bring them to the table to be involved in that review board. And maybe I do believe that the commissioner should be able to appoint, but the review board in its entirety, no.
410-319-8888. Robert, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
I talked to you probably 3 weeks ago on pretty much the same issue, but I felt it was important to speak to your mayoral candidate.
Okay.
I'm afraid I can't remember his name. But
Joshua Harris.
Joshua Robert Olson. I look at I don't know the east side so much as the west side, and I look at the west side, and there are, more than 60% of homes on any given block, all the way out to where Covington and 40 meet, that are boarded up, and they got city numbers on them. So I assume the city's got some control over them. Maybe there's absentee landlords that they don't care to mess with. But this was about getting kids who live in those neighborhoods, who probably school isn't doing anything for them, and they drop out, they walk away, and maybe the coroner attracts them, and then I suspect there's a good number who the coroner frightens, and they just stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
But, so do you have a question?
Okay, no. We have a number, and I'm one, just about to retire as a really good carpenter, restoration primarily, but there are masons and plumbers and other guys that are, 62, 65, 70, that they're not working hard anymore. They may take some small gigs, but they could teach.
Well, you bring up a great point, and that's actually something that's been consistently in my platform, and understanding the importance of the trades, understanding that there's a large constituency of those skilled labor workers, workforce, that are about to retire, and making sure that we invest in training the young people and exposing them to that within the curriculums of education, which we didn't touch on, but making sure that we're exposing them to the inside the curriculum so that they have access and options once they get to 12th grade to say, well, I don't necessarily want to go to college, but I liked wood shop. I really enjoy that. I want to become a carpenter. I want to go into construction, or I want to become a brick mason, or I want to become a plumber, knowing that we have miles and miles of lead pipes that run through our city that our water's running through, again, that need to be replaced, and there's going to be work to done. And so that we want to make sure that we have the workforce here to do that, and that the skilled workforce to do that is definitely something that's been a staple of my platform, and making sure that we put the that our trades are back in schools and back in education.
So, Tim, I get these two questions here in the last 5 or 6 minutes that we have. There are two pieces of legislation inside the city council now that would diminish the mayor's power. One would be to take the appointed members, not allow them to have a vote on the Board of Estimates, but just the three elected officials that are there now, and B, to allow the city council not just to detract from, but to add to the budget and manipulate the budget. So that changes the whole nature of the mayoralty.
Mm-hmm. It does. And so for me, I also look at this. So another staple in my platform, which I haven't released yet, but it'll be coming soon, we're finalizing it, is actually participatory budgeting. And so bringing the communities most impacted into the process, and knowing that we have 14 councilmatic districts. So what would it look like if we gave each one of those districts their own budget to really begin to invest in the things that are needed in each one of those communities to make those decisions and give the power to the people, not necessarily elected officials, but to the people to really have a say in what's needed and what's going to most be impactful for the community and serve the greater good for those districts. And so that doesn't necessarily concern me as much. It does concern me if we're saying, well, we're just going to give it over to this one person, or that the council just decides that we want to add or take this away without having any public inclusion or reflection or involvement in that process. Because, again, I'm all about bringing more people, grassroots democracy, and bringing more people to the process to have their voice heard.
But do you agree or disagree with the idea that the council should have more say in the budget?
I believe that the council should have more say in the budget and how it's used to make sure that the communities, they know their districts, they know, or at least they should. They should know their districts better than most, and they should know what community members are actively involved and what the needs are. And we have to really begin to shift the capital away from just the one place, downtown, and anything that touches the water, which is, again, what we see at Port Covington, to invest in the rest of Baltimore and the rest of our neighborhoods so we can transition them into the 21st century. And they have to have a voice in that.
Be they Democrat, Green, or Republican, there are going to be 8 new council members, whoever mm-hmm. those people are, come November. One last question here, because we're almost out of time. Sonia Santelices was just named CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools.
Mm-hmm.
Many people are very excited about the fact she would be named CEO because of her past and what she says. People are also, even those who like her, are going, we don't like the process of the lack of transparency. So how do you weigh in on this?
Well, there's a major lack of transparency in the process, and that's definitely a concern. I was actually at the PCAB meeting the other day.
PCAB?
Yeah, the Parent Advisory Committee for the Board
just want folks to know, right?
Of Education. And there were a lot of people who were frustrated and upset about it. For one, there was no real rationale for replacing Dr. Thornton. They said that he had been great with the budget and getting them back fiscally responsible, but then they said that there was concerns about really being able to move the education component forward. And to me, that would say, don't get rid of him. You keep him there because he's the chief executive officer, and you bring someone in as an addition to help with that. There's also questions around how long ago was the decision made, who paid for the executive committee search. I believe that the Sun printed an article said that there was a private company or organization that paid $36,000 for the executive search. So there's questions as to whether or not that was tied to charter school movement or someone who's a proponent of charter schools versus public schools. And so there's been a real lack of transparency with that. I actually heard rumors back in December about it, and I wasn't sure. And here we are 4 or 5 months later, and it's like, oh, wow. All right. We didn't see that coming. And so how do we make sure that we are bringing people into the process to have their voices heard? And a lot of people really like Dr. Thornton. A lot of the parents, they said, I listened to them and they talked about him being more present than any other CEO they had ever seen before, that he was in the schools. The students showed up and they spoke highly of programs he had implemented to really bring them into the process and understanding the administrative process of the Board of Education. And so there's definitely some concerns there, although we're excited to have new leadership. How can we make sure that this doesn't happen again and that we are really moving forward in a transparent manner, even if we don't necessarily like what may come from us having to reveal what the plans and intent are.
So we'll see you again on the campaign trail, we are sure, and we'll get you back in the studio here, and hopefully we'll organize some debates here with WEA and other partners for the three candidates seeking to become mayor of Baltimore. Josh, good to have you in the studio. How do people find your campaign?
Oh, you can visit my website, harrisforbaltimore.com. You can find me on Facebook. That's Harris for Baltimore. Twitter, Harris for B More. Instagram, Harris for B More. I'm not hard to find. We're just working to make sure that Baltimore transitions to the 21st century, and it's really a city that works for all of us.
Joshua Harris, Green Party candidate for mayor of Baltimore. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
Talk to you real soon.
It's always good.
All right.
It was a pleasure.
We're going to take a short break. And Avasha Daya and Fanon Hill are in the studio, so stay with us for some new excitement coming out of Cherry Hill and more.